is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
He loved Iceland, and that's all it took for me. It was one guy saying, you're going to like it. No matter what you think, you're going to like it. So sure enough, you're on a plane and touch down in the land of Northern Lights there in Northern Europe, and now you're a young coach that is in Europe.
Eric Olson is the head coach of the Ho Chi Minh City Wings in the Vietnam Basketball Association. He has traveled the globe coaching in Denmark, Sweden, Scotland, Iceland, and Australia. After finishing his collegiate playing career at D3 Linfield University, Eric played professionally in the UK, Germany, and Australia. He began his coaching career as a player coach in Australia before moving on to Iceland, where he eventually became involved with their national team. He moved to Scotland as their national team coach at age 29, before his stops in Denmark, Sweden, and finally Vietnam. Hey Hoopheads, Dr. Dish Basketball is ringing in the new year with big savings. This January, buy one Dr. Dish, get one free, or unlock exclusive single unit discounts during their 2024 Super Sale. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Those are some great deals, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Jack Leisure, head basketball coach at McQuaid Jesuit High School and director of Jack Leisure Shooting and Skills Camp, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Grab your notebook as you listen to this episode with Eric Olson, head coach of the Ho Chi Minh City Wings and the Vietnam Basketball Association.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klimzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to welcome in international basketball coach, currently coaching in Vietnam, Eric Olson. Eric, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
We are excited to have you on and get an opportunity to learn about all the various stops that you've had in your coaching career, what you've learned coaching all over the globe, and some of the lessons that I'm sure you'll be able to share with our audience here as we go through the podcast tonight. I want to start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me how you fell in love with the game of basketball. What are some of your earliest memories?
Well, that goes far back. My father was a NAIA head basketball coach in the Midwest, a school that is now Division II Black Hills State University. So I grew up, you know, being that kid that was 4, 5, 6 years old, standing in the corner of the gym, you know, holding the ball when the coaches were talking and watching practice and kind of being around things. So from a very young age, I had the pleasure of, you know, being around teams, you know, seeing how everything operated, seeing how, you know, how the coaching meetings would go, the film meetings, the trainings, and just, you know, being fully immersed from a young age around the game. And obviously when that's the situation, you know, you're going to fall in love with it. And since then, you know, play in high school, play in college, and play overseas, and then have an opportunity to make the jump into coaching myself. And I guess, you know, it's been a great ride thus far, but it all comes back to the round ball and the thing that we all love, which is, you know, the game of basketball.
As a kid with your dad coaching, did you as a player, I'm always curious because I think different people have different responses and different ways they thought about the game when they were playing it. Since your dad was a coach, did you as a player, do you feel like you saw the game strictly as a player, or were you already starting to maybe look at the game through a coaching lens just because of the influence of your dad when you were playing, let's say, as a middle school or high school player?
Yeah, I think for sure I would see the game as a coach, even if I didn't quite realize it. Drawing plays on a napkin, maybe, as a kid, which, not really a normal, normal activity for a kid to be drawing, right. X's and O's on a napkin because you see your old man doing it, or you see the coaching staff doing it. So I think I definitely think the coaching influence was there from a young age, and then you're a captain of your high school team or a captain of your college team. And, you are going to act more, more strategically like a coach maybe at certain times. So that influence was certainly, pretty profound on my career, seeing the game from a different lens, right?
How much influence did your dad have over your development as a player? So as you started to take the game more seriously, as you got a little bit older, how did your dad help you to improve? Was he hands-on, hands-off? What was that relationship like between the two of you in terms of not just father-son, but also kind of player-coach?
Sure. I mean, of course, coaches' kids are usually going to be pushed a little bit more. You're getting coached, at a younger age, versus just involving in the game. So, I certainly remember my father, the American dream, you're outside in the driveway, shooting hoops, playing one-on-one, that type of stuff. And then as you get older, I was very fortunate to have really good coaches that would, put me through workouts or, give me feedback or try to, support my development. So I really had a good mix of, my father, of course, being hands-on and wanting his son to succeed and wanting to help and wanting to be a good father. Also had, his staff, his assistants, even his players sometimes, they'd want to put you through a workout or come watch a game and give you feedback. So it was really, I was fortunate as a player to really have that, to have that access, obviously. And those things stick with you. So, some of my good friends now, even at this, this point in life, are still the guys that 20 years ago, 25 years ago, were rebounding for you and trying to, get your follow through right and your footwork right.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So as a high school player, give me your favorite memory. What's something that sticks out? Could be a game, could be a moment, could be just the general experience of teammates. Just what sticks out for you when you think about your high school career?
Yeah, for me, there's, of course, like everybody, there's a lot of memories. I particularly remember being a very young, skinny shooting guard that was a sophomore in Minnesota playing in the state tournament. And our team was the Moorhead Spuds. We were in the northern part of Minnesota at the moment, and we were playing against Chris Humphreys' high school team from Hopkins High School in Minnesota. And me, he was the player of the year in the state of Minnesota at the time. And, we were the kids from the sticks up there outside of the city. And I vividly remember, just the level of that game, myself not being ready to compete, at that level as a sophomore, and watching Chris Humphreys go out there and, really just dominate the game from A to Z for 32 minutes. It's something that stuck with me, going, into junior, senior year and into college, just watching elite players, even from a young age and seeing the noticeable difference in the effect they can have on a game and how comfortable they are playing the game. And, I can still remember, Chris Humphreys getting the ball, 14 feet from the basket, and it was just a bucket every single time. And, just that game, that sticks into my memory bank as one of those, wow, you're sitting here as a kid trying to get on the court and you're watching Chris Humphreys drop 40 on you and you're 15, 16 years old. And that one sticks with me.
It's kind of amazing when you think about guys like that who eventually obviously make it to the NBA. And clearly there are some guys that are late bloomers. And then there are some guys who, when you see them as a high school player and you just see the level of physical tools that they have, to say nothing of their basketball skills, but right. just from a a body standpoint, how differently those guys are built. I mean, I had two experiences. One, actually, I had three. So one was Jerome Lane way back in the day. And Jerome Lane was just like, dude was built. His legs were like tree trunks. I remember being on the floor with him at one point. And then obviously I never played with LeBron, but saw LeBron as a high school player and clearly a man among boys. And then the other guy I saw back when he was in high school, and this was even pre-internet, I watched him play. I wasn't on the court with him, but heard about this guy here in Ohio, Jimmy Jackson, who played for Toledo McCumber High School. And I saw him when he was a sophomore. My dad and I drove to a game, and we had never seen a picture of him, never knew anything about him, just had heard about this kid. And we show up and we're like, wonder if we're going to be able to tell who he is. And sure enough, he comes out for warm-ups. You're like, yeah, that one. You're like, that one's Jimmy Jackson. Clearly, look, built was built exactly like he was built when he was a rookie with the Dallas Mavericks. He looked exactly the same as when he was in 10th grade. And those guys are just – they're just built differently.
That's the Chris Humphrey story. Same thing. Man amongst boys at the time. You know, his body didn't really change for, you know, in those years after. You know, but you, like you said, it's sure noticeable when you step, you know, when you watch a game and, you know, some of these elite guys, you know, it stands out to you. Now it's a different game, obviously. There's so many high level players, and, you know, it's the game has really developed and grown, and the gap is much smaller. So, you know, maybe it's a little bit different now, but, you know, it's certainly noticeable still when you see these, you know, those elite guys like you just mentioned.
Absolutely. All right. Tell me a little bit about your college decision, how you end up going to Linfield, what the recruiting process was like for you, and when did college basketball start to get on your radar?
I mean, I was a small school guy, right? As we're transitioning there from talking about LeBron and Chris Humphreys, and you know, I was a Division III basketball player, right? My recruitment was much different. You know, I would try to get myself seen. I would go to, you know, exposure camps, you know, the five-star invitational, you know, anywhere you could go where you were going to be around good players and, you know, college coaches. And like you mentioned earlier, late bloomer, early bloomer, myself being a Division III basketball player, I was a late bloomer. You know, I kind of made the decision to go to Linfield just for a great education in a sports environment, you know, with a pretty strong basketball program. Now, Linfield is small school, but it's known for having an unbelievably powerful football program at the Division III level, being a national competitor every year. And I think they've got the longest winning streak of all football programs in America, as far as it's like 50 seasons in a row with a winning record. I mean, it's a strong program. So basketball wasn't really on the map. And me being a late bloomer, my career didn't really take off until I was a junior and then senior. You know, I had a couple of good games towards the end of my career, and that opened up just enough doors to be able to transition into playing overseas.
For your professional career.
That's correct.
Tell me a little bit about how does that happen for you? Because again, I think it's far more common today for players at the NAIA or Division III level to be able to get an opportunity to play overseas, but it feels like something that in the past it wasn't quite as easy to do. So what was that process like for you? How did that become a reality?
You're 100% accurate on that. It's a different, it's a little more accessible now, again, with the technology, with the access that coaches have to diving into a player's career. Back then there weren't a lot of guys, that were able to go overseas, and have the opportunity. And it was on my, it was kind of on my bucket list, my dream, you know, my dream, my goal was to at least experience the different cultures, one way or the other, whether it be to travel and teach English or, you know, I wanted to get outside and experience some new things. So on my radar right away was, maybe I got to do some things here to have the opportunity to go to a foreign country and play basketball. And the process with that, nowadays, maybe you're going to tryouts and maybe you're going to, invitationals with other players. None of that stuff existed, you know, 15, 16 years ago, really. It was more, you better hustle a little bit. You know, you better put a highlight tape together. And, you know, I didn't have an agent. So, you know, you're sending the stuff out to teams. You're cold calling coaches or GMs, you know, and trying to get your resume on a couple people's desks that it might be the right fit. So that was kind of my process at that time. I had a really strong second half of my senior season, and you know, I would just take those games, full games, highlight tapes, and you know, and send it via email or a phone call to as many people as I could. And you know, one day the phone rings, and you get an opportunity to, you know, to actually go somewhere, and that's, you know, that's sometimes it takes one opportunity, and you know, the rest is kind of, you know, history in some ways.
Where was the first place you went?
Well, the first opportunity I had was to go to Scotland, actually, in the United Kingdom. And it, you know, it was a small level. Coach John Bunyan, who was a very storied coach in the United Kingdom, an older gentleman, been coaching, you know, 20 years and kind of built the program from the ground up. They picked up the phone and wanted me to come for a 3-month stint for not a lot of money, and to stay with a Scottish family inside their house as a homestay. So, you know, again, if you want to have the opportunity to jump overseas and maybe, you know, start something, you know, you're ideally, you might have some, you know, some things you think you might need, a salary, and, you know, a decent amount of money. And, you know, I didn't have any of that. It was like a $500 a month type of gig and stay with the family.
What was it like for you going overseas as a young guy? Obviously in the UK, you don't maybe have quite the same language barrier that you might initially in another country, which I know you played in Germany, and we could talk a little about that. But just what was the adjustment like for you no longer living in your home country? Forget about the basketball side of it.
Sure. And that's one thing that I would recommend to, you know, to everybody graduating from university, or, you know, a younger, you know, student athlete or student in general that's, you know, about to start their career. I mean, for me, seeing something new and getting outside the U.S., outside of your comfort zone, outside of your bubble, you know, for me, it was, you know, life changing, obviously, you know, just to experience new things, meet new people, you know, and be pushed to adapt. So, you know, moving outside the U.S., as a young kid, to be honest with you, to be fully honest, I didn't really think about it. You know, it was more just here's this opportunity. You know, I'd like to give it a go. You know, like to take a chance and, you know, really see what could happen. You know, obviously basketball wise, you want to keep playing, you want to have an opportunity to, you know, to keep doing what you love. But, you know, other times you just have to jump into an opportunity and make it work. And that's really what it was for me at that age. You know, you got a guy that you don't know, you've never met, you know, he's telling you you're going to stay with this really nice family in Scotland. You know, yeah, you don't really know what you're getting into. But there you go. You know, 1 week later, you're on a plane. You know, you just get your passport, you never used it. You know, you're looking at this thing and, you know, what am I getting into? And, you know, it was kind of just, he was right. It was a great family. It was a really good situation. It was a small town in Scotland. We ended up going 3 months and winning the Scottish Cup. You know, their first time for the club. You know, I was MVP of the Scottish League that season. You know, so things could have gone much different. If you go out there and don't win, or, you know, you don't put the pieces together, that could have been my one and only opportunity. But, you know, it turned out the other way, where it worked for both sides. And you're able to kind of build off that and take it to the next opportunity.
Well, did you stay in the UK after that, or did you immediately move? I know you eventually ended up in Germany next.
Right.
Was that an immediate move, or did you stay in Scotland for a little bit of time?
Right from that season, again, being a guy that didn't have an agent, didn't have anybody representing me at that time. I took that, again, that film, and those, you know, those stats and that, those connections. I went right to Germany and tried to find a team that would, you know, consider employing me for the following season. So went to Germany, traveled around Nuremberg and Berlin, south of Germany, the north of Germany, and just, you know, again, try to get in the gym, try to meet some coaches, try to play in some open runs, be a part of a couple of teams in their off season and make a good impression. So it was really, it went immediately right into, I better find the next opportunity because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go home and start a real job. You know, so I went right out and got out there and tried to find the next gig. And it worked enough. I was able to jump in with a Pro B team at the time. They're now Pro A. And this was a team called Ehingen in the south of Germany. And they were a strong team. And I was only able to spend 2 months with them before statistically not being good enough, right? So I went there. I had a good opportunity to continue to play. You're in practice. You're trying to get better. And then, you know, the coach brings you in and says, you know, you're not the right fit for the group. We need a bigger guard. They brought in a Division I guy. And just like that, you know, just like that, my German experience was over. So now you're back to the drawing board. You know, now, again, if you don't have an agent and you're not a high-powered D1 guy or a Division II All-American or whatever it might be, you know, I had to go back to the drawing board. And then from there, the next couple of years got really interesting with the opportunities I had to take and try to make work. And so I ended up taking a high school job from Germany. I took a high school job in Idaho that was immediately open. Like 2 weeks later, it was open after getting cut. And now I'm a 23-year-old, you know, head basketball coach in Idaho, you know, in the middle of nowhere. Okay. So now I'm a basketball coach in Sun Valley, Idaho, a great little town, a skiing town with a population that didn't give a lick about basketball. But I did that for 4 months and built that program up. And then again, the phone rings and now I have a chance to go to Australia and play. So I finished the season as a coach of 23 years old. And I immediately flew to Australia to spend the next 6 months playing in the Waratah League of Australia. Okay, and that was like a year round coach in Idaho. Go to Australia, and now I've added a third country kind of to the resume. And yeah, I did that for 2 years. So I went back to Idaho after I played in Australia. And then I went back to Australia again a second time as a player coach, which was also kind of common back in the day. There was, you know, player coaches. So that was that's really how my coaching career started, was, you know, going to Idaho and taking a chance at a high school program, and then going to play again and turning that pro job in Australia into a player coaching job.
All right. So let me dive into your mentality. At that point, where you're back in Australia to play, you're also coaching this team in Idaho. Was there any thought when you were in Idaho that was the place you wanted to be? And maybe you were looking for a more settled life, or were you still, hey, I want to be in Australia?
At that point, I really still wanted to be a player, which is what it was. You know, I was 23, 24 years old in that period. I really wanted to see if I could continue to play. So when I was in Idaho, you know, I was coaching, you know, 16-year-old kids. It was really a good learning experience. I learned a lot about the game, actually, you know, trying to teach guys that couldn't dribble, pass, or shoot. You know, like I learned a lot, you know, I learned a lot about the game of basketball from being in that type of situation. So I was hungry as a mentality, you asked. I was hungry to just keep building, you know, whatever it was going to be, to try to keep building experiences and, you know, like a network of contacts. And that's, you know, so when the phone rang the second time in Australia to come back as a player coach, it was kind of like a no-brainer. You know, what a cool experience to, you know, to be playing professionally in Australia, and, you know, they're going to give you the reins of the team to be the coach as well. I mean, it was kind of a unique, you know, a really unique opportunity at that time. And, you know, those player coaching jobs are gone now. You don't really see that anymore anywhere. But to be doing that at 24 years old, a player coach in Australia, I mean, it was, you know, it was a once in a lifetime opportunity. And, you know, we had a lot of fun doing it. You know, we had some success doing it. And, you know, that's where my early career, you know, early life of being around coaches and being, you know, drawing plays on the napkin. And, you know, now you have to mesh, you know, being a good player and, you know, being the right coach for what the team needs. You know, so for me, those were just kind of like unbelievable experiences to go from Idaho, you know, guys that can't dribble, pass, or shoot to, you know, the small high school level in a ski town to going to Australia to being a professional player coach. I mean, those are two opposite ends of the spectrum.
All right. So this is a first on the pod, a player coach. So what I want to know is, how do you balance what you're doing as a player with what you're doing as a coach? Did you lean more one way or the other? Obviously, at this point, you're young. You went back to Australia because, sure, as you said, you still wanted to play. So I'm just curious where, what the mentality was, maybe how you split your thoughts in terms of how much were you focused on your performance as a player versus what you had to do as a coach?
Yeah, that's a great, that's a great question. I mean, I often think back about what my mentality was, you know, at that point in my career. And, I mean, you had to be a good player to keep your job first. You know, that was ultimately, you know, they needed to win. They wanted their import player, as they would, you know, as they would call it in Australia, they wanted their import player to produce. So you had to be aggressive. You know, you had to maybe shoot the ball a couple more times than you normally would want as a coach, right? You know, you had to force some of the action sometimes. Right. But, you know, I was fortunate because we had a very talented team. So we were able to, and they were an experienced team. So we were able, really able to, like, you know, you could say, let's go four out with one low post. Let's go five out, you know, or let's run flex. You know, we were able to kind of do some things like basic, you know, just with a, having a smart group that was pretty talented. So we were able to kind of play, you know, play good team basketball, score a lot of points. You know, we brought a lot of fans into the club and really built it up. And, you know, by the end of the season, you know, we were, I got coach of the year, you know, player of the year award, you know, in Australia, and our team won, you know, we were in the finals that year. So, I mean, it ended up, we ended up hitting on everything. Sometimes you hit, sometimes you miss, that, that group, really dialed in and hit, but, you know, me being our coach's kid, again, I, you know, I was always thinking about coaching, what we got to do defensively, you know, what's not working pick and roll wise, you know, what's our change of pace, defense that we can go to. So player coach, 24 years old, I was still thinking about, you know, we got to play winning basketball, you know, and that's, you know, if you want to do that, then your equations get simpler. If you just want to play good basketball.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think, from a standpoint of, right, you're trying to put together, no matter whether you're on the player side or you're the coaching side, you're trying to put together a winning team. You're trying to put together a good combination. You're trying to do things that are going to help your team to be successful. You're just kind of looking at it from dual perspectives at the same time, which is really interesting. Were you at this point?
I mean, so it was tough because you got to keep guys, you know, you got to keep guys motivated, and you don't want to be the, you know, you can't be the guy that's, you know, it's all about you taking the shots and getting your own, you know, you can't have that. So you had to show that you were about the team. So, you know, we made it an emphasis to be the best defensive team, in the league. So, you know, we were on each other. We had a good atmosphere of toughness. You know, we were just kind of like united on the defensive side of the ball, and that really kind of built up our core and our mentality to where everybody, you know, everybody trusted each other. Everybody knew that, you know, coach isn't here to get his own, you know, that type of mentality. You know, because when you're in a foreign country, you know, and you're the new guy, right? Or you're the outsider, maybe not the new guy, but you're the outsider to the culture. You really got to get people on board with you. And they got to know that you really have their best interests, you know, at heart, and you got to mean it. And, you know, some of those guys in Australia are still, you know, great friends of mine, you know, a long time later. I talked to my assistant coach yesterday. We, you know, talking about technology and the access we get. You know, you can pick up the phone and, you know, and call people around the world. So Australia, you know, these were really like development jobs early in my career. You know, that gave me a great foundation forward and a lot of tough situations to be in that you can build off of.
At this point, so you got a couple seasons of experience in Idaho. You got this player coach experience under your belt in Australia. At this point, what are you thinking about in terms of a longer term plan for your career? Are you thinking, hey, I really am enjoying this professional basketball experience. This is kind of the direction that I want to go with it. Was there ever a thought to come back to the States and be, okay, I'm going to get a teaching job and be a high school coach, or maybe I want to get in and coach at the college level? What were you thinking about, or did you have a plan, or was it more just, hey, whatever the next opportunity is, I'm going to take a look at it? What were you thinking at that point?
At that point, I was thinking, I was definitely thinking about how to get into the highest level of basketball I could at that point. If that meant being an NCAA assistant, that was on the table. You know, those were things that I would consider. You know, the development league and G League, it was a different thing. It was a different thing back then. So for me, it was kind of like the route was probably going to be NCAA, high school, obviously, but you know, you have to factor in. I didn't want to be a teacher at that point. You know, I wanted to stay in basketball at a high level. So, I just kind of, you know, just buckled down and, I remember interviewing for assistance jobs at the NCAA level. But you know, at that time I'm 25 years old, and then I was a player coach in Australia. I didn't have a great resume at that point. You know, plus all the connections that later I would add for recruitment around Scandinavia and Europe. I didn't have that stuff at that point. So I wasn't that attractive as a 25-year-old guy trying to get into an assistant situation at the NCAA level. So once I realized that, the challenge became, you know, how can I build off this, you know, this into something bigger? And then again, the phone rings one day. You know, maybe 2 weeks after going through this process and you're stuck a little bit into what you want to do, the phone rings and, you know, I get an opportunity to go to Iceland. And, you know, I didn't even know where Iceland was on the map at that point. you know, so I'm in Australia, you know, and I get a call to go to Iceland again, other side of the world. You know, and you start Googling it and you realize that there's not a lot of sunshine. It's a cold place, you know, and there's not a lot of people that live there. So it wasn't that attractive on the surface, obviously. But I knew they had really good basketball, and I had known an American coach, Jeff Cotilla was his name, who was a very connected guy in Scandinavia. And, he was a college coach for a long time, and he made the jump, into being a professional coach after he met his wife. And he loved Iceland. And that's all it took for me. It was one guy saying, you're going to like it. You know, no matter what you think, you're going to like it. So sure enough, you're on a plane and touched down in the land of Northern Lights there in Northern Europe. And now you're a young coach that is in Europe. And we were a bad team. We were in the second division of the Icelandic Pro League, and it was a tough job, but you know, I had to take it, and so I was done playing. You know, I was not a player coach. I was not a guy trying to play. I knew my career was over at that point, but here I was trying to build now a team and a program and a culture in the Icelandic pro system.
How did you go about putting together sort of your philosophy of how you wanted to play? Who were your influences in terms of, from an X's and O's, offensive and defensive philosophy? How did you kind of build that as a head coach?
Well, I think being the first, that's a great question. I think this a little bit. I think being a young guy, I was a young coach. Many of the players I had were older than me. You know, at that age, a lot of the guys were older than me, were veteran guys. I mean, you have this idea of how you want to play, you know, what style you would like to play. And then you look at your roster and you think, can they do that? You know, or are we capable of winning if we do this? So at that age, my philosophy was really like, what can we do with this group to give us the best, you know, the best chance to win, you know, regardless of like how I want to play, you know, what kind of Princeton action we want, you know, I would like to run, or, you know, flashy defensive set, you know, flashy defensive look at that time, whatever it might be. I was really concerned with taking over a bad team, losing, and then that was kind of the only opportunity I was going to get to be a pro coach. So when I was that age, my philosophy was, you know, we just got to take care of the basketball, rebound the basketball, you know, and take open shots. That was my philosophy at that, you know, at that point in my career, just to give us a chance to improve our record from, you know, being an eighth, ninth place team before I got there. To, you know, just make enough improvement to where you're going to get a second season, you know, and a second chance to, you know, to recruit, bring in a new American, you know, maybe add some young guys, develop the guys you have. For me, it was like a 2-year season, that first job in Iceland, kind of a 2-year season where you're trying to get to year two, trying to improve your record and build some momentum. So my philosophy really was quite simple at that stage in my career. You know, like David Blatt was a guy that everybody in Europe that was foreign, you know, an American guy, everybody would look up to, you know, this American coach that was at a high level. David Blatt was, you know, he was rolling in Europe at that time. You know, he was well respected. So like these are the guys you would watch and you'd say like, wow, you know, how'd he get to his level in Europe, you know, being an outsider, you know, being the only foreigner in that country. You know, the 4 years I was in Iceland, I was the only American there for 4 years. You know, so there weren't a lot of American guys, you know, trying to get into the European system yet. And that's changed over the last 5, 6, 7 years. There's a lot more Americans now. But, you know, back then there just weren't that many guys that were, you know, trying to break into the European, you know, system, right? It's a completely different thing. So I was one of the only, you know, the young coach from America in Iceland. And first year we were just trying to go from ninth to seventh. And that's exactly what we did. We went from ninth to seventh place and we got the contract for year two. And now we're trying to go back to the drawing board and see how we can, you know, how we can be more successful again.
Describe the process for, let's just go with Iceland, bringing players onto your team. What did that process look like? How involved were you in helping to select the players as the head coach and just kind of how that club system worked in Iceland?
Sure. That's how coaches will, you know, you'll fail or you'll succeed with, you know, your recruitment is that's such an important part of the job. You know, and it's different at a high level, you know, high level EuroLeague. Sometimes the scout might have more power than anybody in the club. You know, but at those levels, you know, lower end of pro basketball in Europe, I mean, the coach is bringing in the guys and, you know, the coach better bring in good guys or it's not going to work. So, you know, I went kind of, when I was signing my first Americans, I was looking at guys like myself. You know, Division II, Division III guys that I knew could adapt, that I knew would, you know, would really be about the program and the culture. So, you know, I signed one of Don Meyer's players when he was at Northern State, Colin Pryor. He was an All-American at Northern State. He, you know, played for Don Meyer late in his career. You know, and Don Meyer and my dad used to coach against each other, in the Midwest. So, once I saw his name and saw he was a Division II All-American coming out of Don Meyer's program, I thought that was the guy that I needed to bring in. And we only got one import, for example, in Iceland back then. It's changed now. You get multiple. In some leagues, you get 5, 6. You know, I've had that as well. But, you know, it's a tough thing signing players. You know, nowadays it's agents and it's, you know, scouts and it's, you know, but – I had to watch a lot of games on my own and make a lot of calls. And, you know, I went with someone I trusted, and that was one of Don Meyer's players.
Trust your gut, right?
Trust your gut. It worked out. He was a great guy. He was all about the team. He stayed with me for 2 years in Iceland, and you know, we ended up my third season winning the, you know, winning the league and moving up into the top division. And he was as much a part of that as anybody. So, you know, sometimes, again, you hit, sometimes you miss. He was the perfect fit at the perfect time for that group. And he's actually still in Iceland. He's married an Icelandic girl. He's played for the national team. You know, he's really had a good career, you know, from that first signing. Kind of same story as me, maybe take an opportunity and run with it. And he, you know, he's certainly on that boat as well.
What is the level of pro basketball in Iceland? What does it compare to here in the U.S. in terms of level of play?
That's a good question. At the top league in Iceland now it's, you know, and even then it was open for, you know, you'd have a handful of foreigners. You know, we had a couple Division I players. We had sent a couple young kids to play Division II basketball in America later. I mean, I think it was like average to pretty good, you know, Division II level of basketball, right? I mean, you've got some guys that are, you know, major conference players that are there as the foreigners. You know, you'll have some really decent European guys that have played in America at the Division I level. And then, you know, your seventh, eighth, ninth man are Division III level players. So it averaged out into being like a Division II or competitive NAI level of basketball in the Icelandic league. And then, you know, then that's the bottom tier of European basketball. Would be like, you know, Iceland and Luxembourg. These countries are on the smaller end of European basketball.
Talk about being involved with the Icelandic national team and what that process looks like for getting involved in it, and then how you go about putting together a national team and just what that experience was like.
National teams are the just incredible experience. I mean, to be a part of someone else's national team program, you know, obviously, you know, it's not the USA, you know, it's not the country you were born in. You know, it's not the country you watch on TV. So I just felt an incredible sense of pride, to be a part of like the Iceland national team. You know, I took pride in it. The players, it was their life. It was, you know, there was a lot of national pride in Iceland being a small country. They're very good at sports. You know, the football team has been in the World Cup. You know, the basketball team has been in the European Championships. And there's only 300,000 people that live in Iceland. Like, it's not a big population. So to be really good at football and basketball at a global level, you know, they do a lot right in their development and, you know, how they take a small group of kids in these smaller towns and develop that talent into, you know, into high level players that stay together and stay with it and stay committed to the programs. And so I took pride in that, and, you know, being a part of a national team, just a great experience. I did it again after that in Scotland, but being that first one, you know, and it was the U20 team, it wasn't the men's team. I was with the U20 Iceland national teams as we were trying to qualify for the, you know, for the FIBA European Championships. And those players were young, and a lot of them have continued their careers at a high level. You know, we had a young 7-footer that's played in Valencia, Spain, and EuroLeague level, and you know, was an NBA prospect for a short period of time. And, you know, there were some really good guards that are still playing EuroLeague, you know, top league Greece, you know, really good careers. And those kids were just young kids at the time. But, you know, any coach out there, any player that's been a part of a national team will tell you, I mean, it's a great experience. Yeah, you know, you feel pride when you're a part of it. And, you know, there's definitely a different element there from, you know, trying to win at the pro level to being a part of like a national team program. It's just it's a cool experience. And there's a little bit more, you know, on the table when you're wearing a country's name across your chest, no matter what that level is. It's a cool experience to be a part of.
Hey, coach, want to take your team to the next level this season? Introducing Game Changer, the ultimate game day assistant with tools to give you a winning advantage. With Game Changer, you can track stats, keep score, and even live stream games, all for free. get the stats and crucial game video you need to lead your team to victory, all from the palm of your hand. Coach smarter this season with Game Changer. Download Game Changer today on iOS or Android and make this season one to remember. Game Changer. Stream. Score. Connect. Learn more at gc.com/hoopheads. That's gc.com/hoopheads.
What's it like working within that structure with people from those other countries? How do they look at you as an American who's, again, outsider, maybe is the wrong word, but just obviously, as you said, it's not the country where you're born. How does that work just from a cultural standpoint in terms of, and I know it's fairly common to have an American coach be involved with a national program in other countries, but just how did that work for you? How did you feel as an American? Did you feel like you were just as much a part of it as anybody else who was kind of in the administration coaching ranks, or what was that like?
This has been a theme in every place that I've gone. I mean, the players have to know wherever you're at that it's about them. That you're invested in them, in their development, in the team's goals. That's been a theme that I didn't quite realize when you're 21 and jumping on a plane to go to your first overseas job. You know, you don't really know what you're getting into. But one of the things I've learned in all these stops and all these, different countries here and there and different levels with, sometimes you have six Americans, sometimes you have one, but it's always been the theme where if the players, if they really know that you're invested in them and, you're trying to develop their game and develop the game of basketball, it's easy to find common ground with players, with other coaches, with administration, with fans. You got to work with like an unbelievable level of energy, and then you got to be selfless and be about the team and their development and their goals. And I've always been able to have some success bridging those gaps and bridging cultures together. But it is a unique challenge in every job. And it is something that needs to be at the absolute top of the list as far as if you're going to succeed, that's what it's going to take, to have a chance to do that.
Now let's build on that thought just in general as a coach, because what I hear you saying is that you've kind of got to get the players to buy in and get them to believe that you're on their side. You're there to help them to grow and improve and do what you can to make their experience the best one possible and help them to get better as a player. Sure. So over the course of your career, what have you learned about building the kind of relationship with players that's necessary in order for them to develop that trust in you so that you can help them individually to get better, but also collectively to be able to build the kind of team that can win out on the floor? What have you learned about building relationships with players over the course of your career?
I can tell you, you're not going to win without good ones. You're not going to have a good culture without good relationships. And I think my situation has been unique in the sense that, I was younger than a lot of, in the early jobs of my career, I was younger than some of the players I was coaching. That was a theme, in Denmark, even with five Americans, six Americans, we had some veteran guys on that team. And, when you're the younger guy, and you're coming in and they have experience, they've played at high levels, whatever that situation might be, finding the common ground is essential into building a partnership together, and that's what it comes down to is being on the same, being on the same boat, paddling in the same direction, the generic talk there. But, of course you want to get the right guys on the bus and the right guys off the bus, but sometimes you don't have a choice. I've walked into teams where everybody's signed and everybody's under contract and they're struggling to win and you got to figure it out how to turn it around, and that's a challenge, right? If you can't send guys out and bring guys in and whatever that might be, well, you got to figure out a different way then at that point. And, it will always come back to having strong relationships, going in the same direction together. And then again, the players knowing that you want them to succeed and you're going to do anything you can to help those guys succeed. And maybe that means, you know, being role specific for certain guys, of course, like, you know, you're going to have to accept a role, but we're going to have success together if we all do it and do what is necessary to win. And those relationships, I mean, I've kept great relationships in every country I've been, but, that's been one of the pleasures of the job. One of the great challenges of, you know, moving around and coaching at different levels in different countries is how do you build common ground with someone that doesn't speak great English? You know, as an American coach, how do you build common ground with a 38-year-old veteran player that's the leading scorer in the history of the league that hasn't won? How do you build common ground around these types of situations? And every situation is different, of course. But I think the ultimate takeaway there is, as far as, you know, how you're going to build a relationship is commitment to each other and the players and the management and everybody knowing that you're a selfless person that is trying to do the right thing at the right time, for the team. And I think if you do those things, you'll have a chance to succeed, you know, no matter where you're at or what level, you know, you're doing what you do.
In places where you've been, where there is a language barrier, how much of the language in terms of just maybe picking up phrases and tidbits of the language, how much do you pick up in the time while you're coaching? How comfortable you get with maybe understanding some basic things or being able to say a few basic things in the language? What does that look like?
That's a tough task. I mean, Iceland was a great, great example there. That's one of the most difficult, oldest languages, in the world. You're trying to pick up what you can, to bridge these gaps. Sometimes you just hope the players will have a basic understanding of English. And I've had teams that are fluent in English, like Iceland. Most players spoke, really proper English, and there was no need to work too hard to communicate. But on the other end of the world, then in Vietnam, the amount of our players that speak English is very small. So I work for the last 3 years, I've worked predominantly through having a good translator, and you're in timeouts and you're on the floor and your translator is an extension of you as the coach. So I've seen, I've seen a couple different scenarios where it's a challenge, and again, how are you going to find that common ground in those situations? But I've tried to take a little bit of the language in everywhere I've gone. So, I could still go back to Iceland and hopefully I could navigate a little bit if I got into a jam with the language there. And, Sweden and Denmark, where they're all, there's some similarities there between the languages. So you were able to feel a little bit more comfortable if you would, leave the apartment and you could, half read a sign or half get things done in the community. it's a unique challenge. That's something that not everybody thinks about, when they think about living overseas. Obviously coaching overseas is, not everybody speaks English. And sometimes if they do, it's a lot different than what you're used to it sounding. And, sometimes you got to put a smile on your face in Vietnam and shake a hand and bow the head and we're in this together type of thing. And, sometimes it works. And, I've got great support here. I've had great support in everywhere I've been, but that language barrier, it can be a tough situation sometimes. And I'm thankful to have good people around me that have really, supported me along the way in each of these jobs. And if you don't have that, if you're on your own, it's a tough thing. I've seen some Americans that, didn't have great support and didn't hit when it was, close. And then, every job's tough and every job's unique.
How about off the court? So, I mean, on the practice floor, obviously you're communicating, you kind of have the same mission, but off the court, you still have to live your life during the time when you're not coaching. Mm-hmm. So what's that like when you're in a place where you don't speak the language, just how do you go about navigating through your daily life while you're coaching in a place where you don't speak the language?
Yeah, I've had jobs where you have some free time, and I've also, you know, Iceland's a great example. I spent 4 years there. I coached the U16 team. I coached the U18 team. I coached the U20 team. I coached the men's pro team. And I ran the basketball academy, which was the only academy in Iceland at that time. So for three of those 4 years, I was coaching all day. You know, I was in the gym, and that was why I went there, was to be in the lab, you know, to learn as much as I could and work with as many players as I could and try to develop a style and a methodology to how you build players. And so that was my Iceland experience, was, you know, coaching 16s, 18s, U20. Pro team, academy, and being involved with the national team. So that was a lot of basketball. So to be honest, I didn't do too much outside of the gym, you know, in a town of 6,000 people in Iceland, right? It was not a big population. There wasn't a whole lot to do, and it was dark all day. So I just took that and ran with it. You know, that was a basketball decision. I was there to learn as much as I could. And, you know, Denmark was much the same. I mean, it was a morning practice every single day. And then it was an evening practice every single night. And, you know, in a lot of games mixed in between that. So, you know, I guess you better love what you do, right? And I think for me, I love coaching and I love working with players. You know, I love watching our opponent and, you know, putting a game plan together, you know, and I just enjoy the process of what a season looks like and what a development model, you know, looks like in the game of basketball. So I'm thankful that basketball is and has been, you know, my life up to this point. So, you know, to answer your question, I guess, not a whole lot outside of the gym, right? It's, you know, you better love what you do, and basketball better be it if you're going to live in a foreign country and, you know what I mean, and try to build a basketball career.
All right. Talk to me a little bit about, and again, we're just talking generalities here, because obviously I know that each situation, each team, each country is a little bit different, but just in terms of generally, how do you put together a practice plan? What's your process for, okay, the previous day's practice ends or the previous night's game is over and we're going to practice the next day? Just walk me through how you put together that practice plan and then what you're trying to make sure that you incorporate in that plan on a daily basis.
Sure. I'll take that from my Vietnamese, from Vietnamese experience out here. But universally and, you know, through my career, one of the things I learned from being around, you know, coaches and career coaches and young assistants and, you know, my father, older coach, and watching Don Meyer on the other sideline, you know, being around the game, I've been a believer that it's, you know, what my team needs this week, you know, as far as in season, you know, what do we need this week? You know, as far as like, what do we got to do to get better? You know, what's the short term vision this week of, you know, what we got to do to be successful. And, I've got my core, you know, core belief in, you know, fundamentals. You know, you gotta shoot, you gotta ball handle, you gotta finish, you gotta do footwork stuff. You know, you have these core, you know, these core things that you have to do that you wanna change and you wanna keep challenging, you know, of course. And that's off season, in season, you know, you need to have a vision for, you know, what are the core fundamentals that, you know, these players need. You know, like this guy needs or that guy needs, and then our whole group, what do we need? You know, you have to have that, of course. But basketball wise, you know, X's and O's and strategy of a team, you know, I've always been, you know, what do we need in the short term? And if we're going to add something, we probably might need to subtract something on the other end of that to simplify, you know, and not letting your playbook get too long, or, you know, your scouting report become too complicated. You know, I believe in keeping things simple and you know, keeping the game what it is, which is sometimes it's a simple game, and a lot of teams will beat themselves, you know, before somebody else will beat you. So I believe in fundamentals, and I believe in daily process of improvement, and then as a bigger picture, I believe in what our team needs in the short term. You know, that's how I would approach every day with, you know, how I'm going to build my practice for that day, for that week. And a lot of times you're going to play a game on a Monday and you're going to play another game on a Friday. So, you know, whatever that might be, you'll have a couple days in between, of course. And, you know, it needs to be get better, but, you know, rest and recover. And then we better be tighter as a group the next game. So these are all factors within your processing. But that's what I love about it. I think that's what most coaches love about it is the day to day and the process and the improvement and then the challenges that it brings.
Talk to me a little bit about the scouting process when you're looking at an opponent, you're watching film. What are some of the things that you look for that A, you can attack offensively, or B, that you feel like you need to defend defensively? And obviously I know there's a ton of things that different teams do and we can't get into every single specific, but just in general, what are some things that when you're watching a team on film, you want to know for sure heading into that next game? What are some of the key things that you're looking for when you watch film and you scout a team?
I mean, early in my career, I like to consider myself an offensive coach early. You know, I really cared about the offensive side of the ball and, you know, like, again, running good stuff and like what system you want to play, and sometimes your team doesn't have those capabilities, doesn't match that vision, you know, so you have to adapt. But, I've fallen in love over the last, you know, 7-8 years with, you know, having defensive minded teams, having really tough teams that are, you know, dive on the ground and we're going to talk and we're going to get back and work together and move together and talk together and rebound together. I mean, I've always just taken pride in, you know, being a good defensive team. And in Europe, that you see both, right? You see teams that are going to run and press and, you know, just like America, you're going to get a little bit of that, and you're going to get teams, Serbian teams and, you know, different countries that are going to run offense for 20 seconds and only shoot in the last 4 seconds of a shot clock. I mean, so you're not going to be able to cover everything, you know, within a game. You have to take away the primary option. You know, that is, you know, obviously what the first thing we're trying to do is take away their primary bread and butter, either score or bread and butter set. You know, you want to take away their comfort level with their go-to, whatever it is. You know, the percentage of times that the other team is going to run an action or isolate this player or look for this. I mean, I think first has got to come back to, you know, you want to take away their plan A, force them to play into their plan B and plan, you know, plan C within their offense. And, and every team, again, on a short turnaround sometimes or a long turnaround, whatever it's going to be, you got to focus first on taking away their primary option and not having your core, you know, your core defensive, philosophies got to stay in place. For me, I like to switch, you know, I like to pressure up and front the post when we can and rotate and scramble and, you know, run teams off the 3-point line. I mean, with a 24 second shot clock, it's the game in Europe, becomes much less manageable, from an NCAA game where you get, you know, you get 4 media timeouts, you know, you get timeouts you can call on the fly. You know, if you don't like what you're seeing, you can call a timeout as a coach. You know, being in Europe and being in the FIBA game, you know, you have to do your work, you know, before the game, you know, and then you have to adjust in the timeouts that you do get, which not that many, right? So, you've got your core philosophies, and you've got what we're trying to take away, plan A and plan B, what we need to take away. And then you're in a game and you've got to adjust, you know, you've got to be able to take those 2 timeouts that you get and change the rhythm of the game, you know, within those, those timeouts, because you're just going to have less time, you know, to talk, to manage. The media timeouts are gone. You're just going to get less time in the game in FIBA, and it just kind of goes up and down and flows a little bit differently. So, you know, I me, I love the FIBA game. I love the way it goes up and down. It's a faster game. You know, there's less stoppages of play. So now I'm completely used to it. You know, I'll still debate with, you know, my friends that are college coaches, and, you know, we'll still debate, you know, what's the better style of basketball, better, you know, and it's truly a different game. You know, FIBA is truly a different game to what an NCAA game looks like. You know, it's just, it's a, almost not a different sport, but it feels differently when you're watching it just because of the tempo is different. And, you know, the less stoppages of play, you know, kind of make it an up and down event, right?
Less stoppages of play is definitely a plus. Whenever I watch international basketball, I think that's one of the things that truly sticks out. When you watch a college game or you watch an NBA game and you're talking about the last 4 minutes of that game,
sure,
seem to take forever. Even a high school game, my son's a senior in high school right now, and teams that get 5 timeouts and they're saving them all for the last 4 minutes of the fourth quarter. And it just feels like, man, those things just drag on. And a lot of times it's that old saying, right, that a lot of times there's a lot of overcoaching, where if you, sure, just kind of let the players go and figure it out and play through things, that they'd learn to adapt and probably end up making better decisions in some cases than what the coach could make from the sidelines in those last second plays. But definitely from a flow standpoint, the international game is a much more fun product to watch in the last 3-4 minutes, where you're not having to sit through multiple timeouts and stoppages and all the other things that go on here in the States when you start talking about games like that. It's just, again, completely different feel. Talking about film and scouting and preparing for an opponent and putting together practice plans, how much of the scouting report that you put together on a team, or how much of the film breakdown that you do, how much of that gets shared directly with your players? How much are your players involved in? And again, I know it probably varies, again, country to country, team to team, but just in general, your philosophy as a coach of how much of the scouting report that you put together as a coach, how much of that gets shared with your players?
Right. That's great. Great. You know, you love talking about that type of stuff. I mean, I'm an obsessive type of coach, right? I want to know everything. You know, I want to feel like I know everything about, you know, my opponent. I don't expect my team to know everything, right? But me, I want to feel like I know what they're thinking, you know, what they might go to late in the game, you know, what their, you know, end of game sideline play has been in the past. You know, what they go to if they need a bucket, they haven't scored, you know, a couple possessions in a row. I want to feel like I know everything, you know, that could be thrown at you. Now, it's not, you know, that's not conceivably possible to know everything, but you want to work like you're completely and utterly prepared for the opponent. But I've played, you know, for coaches that, you know, you'd spend hours, you know, in the meeting rooms, right? And hours watching film and, you know, getting 7 pages or 8 pages of a scouting report. I've played for those coaches, and I've played for, you know, more the type of guys that you know, less is more, you know, and so I guess I've seen both sides of that. But so I take a little bit of both. You know, we're going to watch film. You know, we're going to watch a lot of their sets. We're going to watch a lot of personnel. You know, we're going to keep our core philosophies, you know, pretty consistent from week to week. You know, maybe change one guy, take one guy out of the pack, or, you know, whatever it might be to, you know, to keep it simple, but take away what they want to do. But I definitely believe sometimes that less is more, you know, and you want your players to be out there playing very hard, you know, playing very together and not overthinking. So I've taken more of that approach where, you know, I don't want to be in the film room for hours with our team. You know, I don't want to hand out 15 pages of a scouting report and expect there to be 100%, you know, understanding of what we're trying to get done, right? So I want to know everything, but I want my players to execute and play as hard as they can and play as confidently as they can. And you know, I'm more the type to spend 20 minutes in the video room, right? And maybe more time individually with players, showing, you know, individual clips. And this, you know, I'm definitely a big believer in, you know, individual development within a team concept. So, you know, so for me, less is more. You know, I've met other coaches that are successful that'll be like me. And then some, you know, Serbian coaches, or, you know, Bosnian coaches, I mean, they'll spend hours in the video room and, you know, that they'll win and they'll feel successful with it. So I guess I've seen both succeed, you know, both have their successes. But for me, you know, it's the individual development in the team concept, and that has worked, you know, with most of the groups I've had, as far as, you know, like end of season playing better basketball and being, you know, more united at the end than you are at the beginning, you know, and evolving all, you know, through the process.
And multiple ways to win, right? I mean,
correct.
There's lots of different ways.
Correct.
That...
Multiple ways to win and not that many ways to lose. You know, it is a simple game. You know, and at the end of the day, it does get, sometimes it gets overcomplicated, and the NBA is its own thing. You know, we're not talking about the NBA. You know, we're not talking about a star-studded league or superstars or, you know, big contracts. When you take that stuff away and you're just, you know, you're coaching, you know, for Denmark is a good example. I had two guys from Texas Tech, had a player from Baylor, you know, had two other, like, you know, mid-Division I players on that team. And, you know, no one was a millionaire and no one was making six figures, but everybody was a really talented player and everybody really wanted to win. You know, and so you get a different brand of basketball. You definitely get a different style of play, but, that, you know, that was a pretty talented group I had there when you're talking about, you know, three, Big 12, you know, level of players in your starting five type of deal. So, yeah, that scouting side and you know, game planning. I mean, that's the beauty of the details. That's where the fun is. You know, you know, if you've got guys that are bought into each other, everything becomes easier. You know, at the end of the day, everything becomes easier.
Absolutely. All right. Talk to me about making the jump from Europe to Asia. You're now currently coaching in Vietnam. Give me some of the similarities, differences, just kind of the general overview, lay of the land, Vietnamese basketball, what it looks like in your eyes.
Sure. Sure. And even how I got to Vietnam is a story. You know, I was coaching in Sweden and it was, we were two thirds of the way through the season and, you know, COVID pandemic, you know, just the way the world was that, you know, the league shut down in Europe. Sweden was one of those leagues that, you know, that canceled the remainder of the year. You know, so I'm sitting there without a job. The season had just been canceled. We were, you know, you go there to win. We were in second place. We were trying to move up to the top division in Sweden. It was a good situation. It was a good stable club with money behind it. So it was a good situation to be in if it was going to continue. And then one day it wasn't there anymore. It wasn't, you know, wasn't going to continue and the everything was shut down and it, you know, it was going to be like that for a while. So that's how I came to Vietnam. Vietnam was going to run a bubble. You know, they were going to be in a hotel. They were going to play games in the convention center. Everybody was going to stay, you know, isolated and you were going to still have a league to play in. So that to me, that was very attractive. You know, I wanted to coach. I wanted to, you know, keep be around the game. And so that's how I came to Vietnam, was through a COVID shutdown in Europe, and then having the opportunity to come out here to Asia, you know, and be in an entirely different basketball landscape, you know, cultural landscape, other side of the world. You know, and Vietnam is, you know, it's a story within itself, for American guys. You know, like, you know, my grandfather was in the Vietnam, war, right? So I had some ties to this country that, you know, maybe not the best ties to have, but, you know, I had some ties to Vietnam and, you know, it seemed like a place where, you know, I could be comfortable and be involved in the game of basketball here. And it's a growing game in Vietnam. You know, this is a league that's been in place for 7 or 8 years. So basketball is much newer. You know, it's much different, style of play. You don't have, you know, we don't have a lot of 6'8", 6'9", you know, inside Vietnamese players. You know, we have a faster group of guards, you know, smaller, quicker players, that so the style of play becomes different. You know, this everything just kind of changes. And that goes back to earlier in the conversation, speaking about, what style of play do I want to win? Do I want to play? What system do I want to implement? And then looking at your roster, what kind of system do we need to play to have the best, have best chance to succeed? So that's how I entered the Vietnam market 3 years ago, taking a bad job, the last place team the year before. And trying to turn that, into a winning situation. And, sidebar, I mean, there's been six coaches for our club that were all fired after one season. So, mostly Americans, always foreigners, come for 4 or 5 months, don't like it, don't get it done, get fired, whatever the story might be there. I've actually been the only coach now to stay with our club beyond one season even. So it's been 3 seasons in Vietnam. It's a growing market. Asia, the market is huge. The viewership is very big. There's a lot of engagement behind the sport. So it's been a great experience as far as seeing the game again through a different lens, but subjectively not as high of a level of play as what was happening in Europe, with the 5-6 Americans. So again, different ends of the spectrum, but part of the game, grassroots a little bit more, more hands on with the club as a whole. So it's been a really good experience to be out here.
Which one of the countries has the best food?
I would say Vietnam does have the best food. I guess I'm a little biased now. I've been out here a couple of years, but that's been another thing there. You get to experience different things in every place. Iceland was a lot of fish. A lot of fish and potatoes. That was the thing in Iceland and Scandinavia. A lot of meat and potatoes. Germany, the bratwurst, you get different stuff everywhere. But if you're open-minded, I feel like people can, you'll find what you need and what you want, and you'll experience new things. I think Vietnam's got a lot of pluses there on the food side and basketball. It's a big growing market. There's a lot going on as far as like the development of the sport in Asia. It's definitely, there's a lot of money behind the development of the game. And the business venture with things. So, I've definitely seen things from a different perspective now coming out here, I would imagine most people don't know that Vietnam has a professional basketball team. I mean, I did not know that until I needed to know. And it's not it's not like Sweden, or Germany, where it's a pretty good league. It's been different in many respects. I'll have to take this opportunity and, you'll have to turn it into, a different one, wherever that might be. And I think that's always the challenge of taking these jobs. I'm still one of the younger coaches, around Asia. I'm 36 years old. I've had a lot of experience as a head coach in different countries. So I can always look back and then look forward again and just kind of be excited about what that next opportunity might be, when it does come.
All right. This is my standard question for anybody who has experience in any way, shape, or form with overseas basketball. What is your craziest story? PG-13 version. Your craziest story could be on the court, could be off the court. Just the funniest, craziest story that when somebody kind of asks you to tell them what the experience is like, give me that story.
Well, I can't tell you anything about Vietnam because I'm still currently in Vietnam. So we'll leave that.
I understand.
We'll leave that off the table.
Understood.
I always go back to being in Iceland or Australia, but we'll pick Iceland for this one. And the life threatening bus trips that you would have to take, through some of these countries that you're not flying. There's not a big budget for a coach bus. Some of these trips, some of these trips where you're going to drive 10 hours, I remember a 10-hour trip in Iceland, okay, on a minivan, through a dark winter storm, through the cliffs and along the ocean roads and the glaciers. And, I will always tell this, these stories to people, and, you're holding on for dear life on some of these trips where you don't know if you're going to make it. You've been on a bus for 9 hours and you can't see anything, and then you got to play a game, and then again, you got to play a game. You got to win the game. You got to execute. You got to get off the bus with the right mentality, and get the job done. And then you got to drive back. I mean, I've had multiple situations like that in early in my career where you're talking about an 8, 9, 10 hour bus ride, play a game, and you're right back on the bus, driving back home. And I think that's the stuff that, people will see the basketball and people will see the journey. But the experiences come from the day to day, the people you're working with, the players you're working with, and the things that you ultimately go through together, and that's always been the highlight of my time overseas, is the different people I've gotten to work with and meet, the different players that have played for Bobby Knight or played for Don Meyer, and now you're coaching them, and these are the highlights of doing what I've done over my career. But craziest story would have to be those, the 20-hour trips to play a game in a town of 5,000 people and not knowing if you're going to get back, safely to your
absolutely
home. There's been a handful of those where you're just closing your eyes and praying for good luck and safety along the way.
Absolutely. I can completely picture what that would be like. All right, Eric, I want to wrap it up with one final two-part question. So part one, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then part two, when you think about what you get to do day in and day out, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Biggest challenge for a guy like me, a coach, a younger coach still trying to get to a higher level. The biggest challenge is the influx of, American coaches and foreign coaches that, have, with the development of the game and the international growth of the game. For example, in Iceland was the only foreign coach. In Denmark, I was the only foreign coach, American coach. In Sweden, I was the only American coach in the league. And then now I've come to Vietnam, and there's a handful of American coaches, these years later. There's a handful of foreign guys. So I think the challenge in the coaching business is I'm not coaching in the NCAA level, so you don't have, you might not have stability. Right. You might not have a 3-year plan to build your program. I've been 2-4 at times in my career. And, if you lose the next game, you feel like you're probably getting fired. That's happened in my career. So the biggest challenge would be, taking what you're currently tasked with and doing a great job. But the challenge is always going to be, you're going to need that. You're going to have to be building towards, the next thing. But you still have to be fully involved in what you're currently doing, because if you're not, then you're not going to succeed. That's the biggest challenge, is keeping that balance of A to Z, being a worker, outworking everybody that you can and taking the most with what you have. But then at the same time, building your career, and building what could be next and networking what could be next. So that's a daily process. That's something that I've done my whole career, early on, not having an agent, trying to turn opportunity A to top opportunity B, C, while being fully invested every single day and every single practice, and every single second trying to succeed within that moment. So that's a daily challenge. That's an every season challenge. But the greatest joy is always going to be that you're doing what you love. You get to work with players, you get to coach the game. You've had pros, I've had high level guys, I've had guys that can't dribble, pass, or shoot. I've had everything along the way, right? But the greatest joy is that we get to do something we love. We get to do it all for the round ball. We get to be around a game of basketball and make it a part of your life. So I just love working with players. You know, I love helping players get to the next level, whether that be a 16-year-old or, you know, a 38-year-old that went to a Final Four with, you know, Bobby Knight. You know, you have both ends of the spectrum at all times. But the greatest joy is going to be, you know, getting on the floor and working with people and being a part of something that's bigger than yourself, you know, within a group dynamic. And, thankful to have had these experiences and thankful to be able to share them with you guys, you know, and talk a little bit about them. So, it's been a pleasure. Really appreciate you guys, you know, bringing me on board.
Absolutely. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can get in touch with you. So if you want to share email, social media, whatever you got, and then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Absolutely. I feel like you gotta be someone that's approachable and contactable and willing to share your story and help people. Of all the jobs I've ever gotten, it's always been a first or a second connection that's taking you to those opportunities. You know, someone going to bat for you sometimes can just go, you know, can go miles. I would love for any coach out there, any player that, you know, wants to talk about how to get into their first job or be in the game in some different capacity. I'm always reachable. And, you know, being the country that I'm in at the current moment, you know, the best way for people to approach me would start with just an email and a note to introduce themselves, basketballacrossborders@gmail.com. And that is, you know, I will immediately respond and keep an open line of communication with anybody that, wants to talk the game or talk about life or, you know, the sport and what it can do for people.
All right. Cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule tonight. Truly appreciative. So glad we were able to connect from halfway across the world, all the way across the world, however we want to define it. But again, time difference. We figured it out. Thank you for joining us tonight. And we appreciate everyone out there in our audience listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.